Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Welcome to Talk Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shirtlift. This show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and also repeated on Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also hear the show on Podomatic. We have an archive of our programs. Just go to podomatic.com and punch in Camp Constitution. You can also hear us on our YouTube channel. We usually do it within a few days that this show is aired. And there's a few other entities that pick up our show. Anyway, it's brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. And this year's camp is coming up a little bit more. It will be in the beautiful Berkshires of Massachusetts at the Lakeside Christian Camp and Conference Center, August 5th to the 11th. And we have an incredible lineup of instructors, as well as some historical tours scheduled, a hike up Mount Greylock. We have Lord Christopher Monckton, Dr. Duke Pesta, Mrs. Chris Ann Hall, Professor Willie Soon, and other incredible instructors. To learn more about that, please visit our website, campconstitution.net. And also, when you're on our website, check out the Sam Blumenfeld archives. Sam was a dear friend of ours, and we were able to inherit his papers and writings. And we created this incredible resource, free online resource for educators, homeschoolers, and anyone else that would like to see this great man's work. Well, we have a guest online here, and that would be Joe Wolverton. How are you doing, Joe?
Just fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Joe is a constitutional attorney, and he is a contributing editor, or are you a contributing editor to the New American Magazine and other places. I think the Von Mises Institute covers some of your materials, writings, and other sources. And you were from Arkansas originally, but your dad was in the military, so you traveled around the world, or at least in Europe, where you graduated from school there at Frankfurt. Hopefully not the Frankfurt School, though.
No, that's right. No, not the Frankfurt School. A school in Frankfurt, not the Frankfurt School.
And now I would have to, first of all, I think the lovers of liberty and the Constitution owe you a large debt of gratitude because of your incredible articles you've done on the dangers of an Article 5 convention. But you've also are in the process of writing a biography of James Madison.
The book just came out. It's called The Real James Madison. It's a biography. I guess the official national release date is July 4th, but you can order them in advance. And it just came out about a week ago. Came out.
Outstanding. Well, you know, it's interesting because we opponents of a modern day Article 5 convention cite Madison quite often, and of course the other side. It's almost as if I'm reading the same exact thing. But the other side are making different interpretations of what I think is pretty clear. So one of the things that we cite a lot is the letter that he sent to Mr. George Tuberville. By the way, do you happen to know who he was? Was he just a friend of his?
Just a neighbor. Yeah, the Tubervilles were neighbors there in Virginia, in Orange County, Virginia.
And when he wrote this, can you give a little background about this letter? The time frame of the letter and what he was trying to convey to his neighbor.
Yeah, the problem was that after the Constitution, well, even before it was ratified, it starts during the Convention of Philadelphia in 1787. You had several delegates at that convention that were saying, you know, let's go ahead and approve whatever product we get out of this convention, because we can just have conventions in our state that will add amendments and change things, change the text to make it more like we like. And at that time, and this just happened, you know, the odd thing about 2018 is the days correspond to the days in 1787, meaning June 30th was a Saturday in 1787.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I've been doing a series of on this day at the convention on my Instagram page for people. And so just a couple of days ago was the anniversary of, they were arguing about the power of the executive, and one of the, you know, some of the delegates were saying, yeah, let's just go ahead and let them have this one because we'll get it to the states and we'll have conventions. And at that time, a couple of guys stood up, one of them being Madison, and said, you know, conventions are very dangerous things because they never produce what the people who called them promised to produce. And they're like wildfires that you cannot control. And so that was the attitude. But you can see even in that, that there were people saying, well, don't worry, these state conventions, we can change the Constitution as necessary. And so what happened is after the Constitution was ratified, within a few years, you have actually some people from Massachusetts who went up to John Taylor of Caroline in Congress and said, hey, we want to have a convention because we want to secede. The New England states, we want to secede from the Union. And so Jefferson got involved.
What was this time frame? This was the War of 1812, right?
That's right. That's right. Yep. Yeah. It was the early 1800s. And anyway, and then you have in the 1820s a remarkable thing that happened. There's actually a book published by Liberty Fund that tells the story of each one of the states. In the 1820s, you have most of the states of the Union end up holding constitutional conventions to rewrite their state constitutions. And even in those constitutional conventions, you have one, like I say, in nearly every state. And Madison, and it's in that context, Madison, that was his last public act, was to serve as a delegate to the Virginia State Constitutional Convention just a couple of years before he died. And in that context is the letter you're talking about to Mr. Turbeville. So what happened was there were, in the same kind of spirit, there were people saying, well, anytime there's a problem with our Constitution, whether it be state constitution or federal, we can just hold a convention and we can have the people send delegates and we can change the Constitution. So it really doesn't matter if there are errors in it. And Madison, of course, warned that there are dangers inherent in a convention because Madison had learned from reading William Blackstone, who warned that a convention of the people is based upon their natural sovereignty, their God-given right to self-rule. So by very definition, a convention, a constitutional convention of the people, cannot be controlled. And
now,
that was go ahead.
Now, June 30th, this was during the convention, 1787, mm-hmm. where Madison said conventions can be dangerous. Mm-hmm.
No, that was a few days ago. I think it was, I'd have to look at my notes, which I don't have in front of me. I think it was about June 23rd, 24th, somewhere around there. If you look in the records of the convention that Madison kept, you can see in there, and there's a couple of people, Madison among them, and Elbridge Gerry was another one who said, yeah, we can't, this convention business that some of you keep talking about is a dangerous thing. And I understand why some people would say, well, that's Madison talking out of both sides of his mouth, because the convention of 1787 that he was a principal player in itself was a runaway convention. Mm-hmm. I mean, every man sitting in there, whether it be the 55 total or the 30 that was an average number of attendance, every one of them were participating in a convention that violated the power given to it by the people.
But according to Madison, and I believe it was in Federalist 40, that he did acknowledge that they exceeded the tenor of their commission, but
that's
because
right.
it was a sovereign body, I don't know if I'm quoting verbatim,
yeah, no.
that they had no obligation to necessarily follow that tenor. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. The problem, and he's right, and the that in that lie, in that truth of history, lies the greatest argument against these people calling for a modern con, because at the end of the day, would anybody, I mean, first of all, the plain text of Article 5 does not give anyone control over that convention. The second thing is, by very nature of their being, the people enjoy the gift of God of being self-governing all men are created equal. So a convention of the people could not be controlled by its very definition, and Madison knew that. Now, in Philadelphia in 1787, we had the benefit. I mean, let's be honest. We benefited, regardless of the fact that they exceeded their congressional mandate, because we had a constitution, a capital C constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The Articles of Confederation was a constitution. And the constitution contained provisions of how to amend the constitution. Day one, the minute that Edmund Randolph stood up and proposed the Virginia Plan, that convention of Philadelphia in 1787 exceeded its constitutional mandate, because the mandate given by Congress to the states said that their sole and express purpose was to recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation. So you have this uncontrollable power. And the fact is, think about it today. If we had a constitutional convention, do you think, given the influence of billion-dollar political movers and shakers, given the tendency of even state governors and state legislators to scramble and claw their way to be a better place at the federal trough, who do we have that would be a Madison or a George Washington that would stand as a backstop between these avaricious billionaires, these avaricious state legislators, and the ability they would have to completely make it easier to satisfy their avarice? I don't know anyone that would have that kind of power, and there is no inherent power in it. In neither the Constitution nor natural law gives any of us any power over what they might do.
I sometimes joke about it, where I said, yes, if I was a delegate and folks like you and Edward Vieira and Robert Brown, I said we would convene, we would repeal the 16th and 17th, and go home.
Gosh.
It would probably
day,
be
day
10
one.
Meeting.
That's right. That's right.
But,
we would convene. Yeah, that's right. Repeal the 16th and 17th, abolish it, make it add an amendment, absolutely making it unconstitutional to establish the Federal Reserve, and out we go.
And out we go. But of course, that's not likely to happen. Yeah, a couple of things that I want to bring up here that dealing with James Madison. He's mentioned, you're saying at the convention itself, he mentioned historically conventions have been suspect or not to be trusted.
What happened is someone made that statement. I think it was Elbridge Gerry, and James Madison said, yeah, I second that opinion about that.
Well, the important thing, that's an important fact, because some of the folks promoting an Article 5 convention, especially this group called Convention of States, they're getting this information from Professor Nadelson, where he said that states have had all colonial conventions or colonial meetings, and nothing has ever gone wrong. And that's obviously not the case, because you're saying Elbridge Gerry knew better, and so did Madison.
Well, and both of them, and in this case, both of them were saying that historically, the way they did in the convention, they bring up Greece and Rome, but they also brought up to what to them would be relatively recent conventions in Holland and in Venice. But you have them standing up and saying, how did Philip, the second of Macedonia, how did he get power over democratically ruled Greek cities? Because he convinced them that he was their friend, he joined their confederations, and then destroyed it at conventions that they would hold. And this is what they're saying. They say, how do you control a man? Even if it were me, if you send me to a convention, I'm not a man who's accustomed to being tempted by billionaires to sell my principles. I don't walk around day in, day out having billionaires offer me money to sell my principles. But if I were to be sent as a delegate, which, like you say, would never happen in a million years, but if I were, through some magic, somebody waves a magic wand and I get sent to this delegation, and I'm sitting there and you've got some billionaire, whether it be a billionaire on the supposed right or a billionaire on the supposed left, who can sit here and tell me, I can make every dream that you have come true, mm-hmm. and here's the check. How do I know, having never been there? I would hope that I wouldn't.
Yes.
But how do we guarantee that? And at the end of the day, you know, I always have people, when I give these speeches, they say, and Nadelson's one of them, you know, he comes at me, and Nick Dranius, they'll come after me and say, well, Joe, you know that even if those people, if there were bad people in the convention, and they proposed, for example, abolishing the Second Amendment or making the Second Amendment, making it where only the military and the law enforcement could possess certain weapons. He said, you know, the states would never ratify that. And the only thing I ever say to them, I say two words in return to them, 16th Amendment.
Right, that's right, yeah.
I don't want to hear that the states would not approve ridiculous amendments that would be for their worst, because the states approved an income tax. I don't want to hear that they wouldn't
right.
do that.
And when they approved the 17th Amendment, the general election of senators, they stripped themselves of a very important power. So, and we look at some of the states that do a lot of crazy things without an amendment. I mean, I live in Massachusetts. New Hampshire, which is supposed to be a relatively conservative state, the governor, a Republican, just signed into this the crazy bathroom bill, you know, transgender bathroom bill, which is something you would never expect in there. So, by the way, you made reference to a book a little earlier about state conventions. I actually have a copy of it right in my hand. Democracy, Liberty, and Property.
That's the state conventions.
And what's fascinating is another argument that the Article 5 supporters use is that, well, states have had, you know, 200-plus conventions since their existence. And, of course, Massachusetts was the first one in 1780, which gave us this state but they've had some profound things happen. They say nothing has dramatically happened.
Oh, my goodness.
But that's when I first heard that, I said, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I didn't have the information to come back and say, no. But my goodness, just in that 10-year period, but I remember reading a book unrelated to Article 5. It was about famous black patriots of the Revolution by, I think his last name was Nell. It was a black writer. And in the 1840s, Pennsylvania disenfranchised, at their state convention, disenfranchised the blacks, the right to vote. And so there was some profound things that went on.
Oh, absolutely. I wrote an article the other day about, it was about the, it hasn't come out yet because it's going to be in the next print issue of the New American. In particular, this was talking about the impeachment power for the president and for federal officers. But in that, I go through, I forgot how many state constitution I use, and I think about 8 states, and just showing how the differences. You had state constitutions as late as, you know, like you say, the 30s and 40s, that would say something like, no man can hold office in this state unless he swears that Jesus is the Son of God, that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, and that Roman Catholicism is the great whore of the earth. Now imagine that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that today? So when these guys say that, it cracks me up. And, you know, fortunately, when I face off against these guys, they know better than to bring that topic up because I know about it. And, yeah, you get radical changes in state constitutions in the 30s. And even the title of the book says, you know, democracy. You get a lot of these states saying, you know what, let's either one of two ways, either let's give a greater amount of direct democracy in our constitutions, or let's take away power from the people and give it to the landed aristocracy. And so, yeah, you can have to say there's not been radical changes is to really misrepresent the historical record. But that's what they're good at doing.
Oh, I guess they just assume that you don't know, you know, the other side doesn't know these facts. I think a lot of these folks that will say that, they're just reading talking points. They sound convincing. They've never done the research. And then, but going back to James Madison and Federalist Number 10, something that we in the patriotic community quote quite often, where mm-hmm. he said, "Well, you can finish where he said what he said about republics. I mean, democracies.
Well,
I'm sorry. What his
democracies? Yes, they're violent in their deaths, right? Because you can't control them either. Because once you a democracy always ends in mob rule. And they are violent in their death, because what you have is once you have that 50% plus one of the population who desire wickedness and desire tyranny and desire, you know, communism, once or any sort of wickedness, once that 50% plus one other guy desires that, the rest of us are held captive by that. Now, of course, the answer to that is decentralization, right? I mean, vote with your feet, but we don't want to live in a democracy. And our founders, of all the things, now some people say to me, well, they said democracy. Yes, they meant self-rule. But when every time they spoke of the political form of government called democracy, they spoke ill of it, because they knew, again, because they knew their history backward and forward, because from the cradle they were taught Roman history, Greek history, and the Bible, and they were taught the Bible, and they knew that democracy never goes well. It always ends violently, because you're going to come to the point where a majority of the people desire that which is best for, they think, themselves, but bad for others, and you get to the point where it burns down, and then what happens historically? In rides the man on a horse to save us all. And then you have all of these people saying, oh, this guy can rescue us from ourselves. Uh-huh. He, of course, becomes a tyrant, and the circle starts right back up again.
I think, was it Cicero who said something to the effect that once the people can vote themselves to treasury, that's when the democracy, I'm paraphrasing. We have about 8 minutes left, so let's get in to your book on James Madison. And first off, why would you choose that particular founding father of all the founding fathers you could have written about?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was a freshman in college, I was the first one in my family to go to college on either side of my family. And I went to a good school, and I got there, and I fancied myself a smart kid. And I got to college, and my first class, I realized, wow, I'm really disadvantaged here because of the other kids in the class who seemed to always have the answer, and they were talking about things I'd never heard of. I mean, believe it or not, freshman in college, I didn't know what the Federalist Papers were. Mm. And so I went to a professor of mine, a guy named Dick Betterly, Richard Betterly, and I said to him, he was very famous in the Patriot movement, in the education circle. He was a famous pioneer in that era, that area. Anyway, he told me, he said, look, you know, take a copy of the Federalist. He had several in his office. Take a copy of the Anti-Federalist. Go to the index and just write down everything you don't recognize. Write it down, then go to the library and look it up. Well, I wrote them down on these big cards and went and looked it up. And the more I got fascinated with the things that Madison wrote. And the more, so I started to study, like, you know, just read a few books about his life, the Irving Brandt biography, the Ralph Ketchum biography. And the thing that struck me about Mr. Madison was his two things. Number one, his consistency. Lots of people they talk about this Madison problem. There is no Madison problem. The problem is we're so accustomed to it being inconsistent that when someone is consistent for the full length of their life, it's difficult for us to understand. So that's the first thing, his consistency. And the second was his absolute, rock-ribbed adherence to personal morality. This is a guy who, you know, think of the founding father. We're talking, think of the varsity team of founding fathers. And James Madison is about the only one about whom there's never been even a whisper of scandal. And that's because there was no thing to hang on. And you have Jefferson, his friend for 50 years, who went, you know, to Dr. Witherspoon there at Princeton and said, hey, Princeton, I'm writing a biography of Madison. Tell me some of the dirt on Jimmy. What did he get up to? What did he get up to in college? And Witherspoon says to Jefferson, you know, of all the people that have come through Princeton, Mr. Madison is the only one I know of that never said or did an indiscreet thing. Mm, and I mean, that's who you have. And so when I heard that, I was like, yeah, this is a guy I want to know more about. And he's, and everything, you know, he's one of those things that every time I read more about him, I come to respect him more. And I guess one of the biggest things now being, you know, living in this era, you know, James Madison was a sickly kid. I mean, his mom and grandma, the night he was born, called the priest in to give him last rites because they didn't figure he'd make it till the morning. And you got a guy who was 5'4", 120 pounds, and just really sickly, but never, never offered any sort of excuse for not doing the most that he could do. My favorite phrase is he born before the excuse factories were built. And because, you know, today there's, if you can't do something, you can find some excuse, you know, daddy didn't tuck me in bed, mommy didn't hug me. There's some kind of excuse for everything.
Right. Or yeah. Didn't nurse me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But Madison just moved on and did his thing and never offered excuses. And the funny, you know, the ironic, I guess, or paradoxical thing about it is here he was born sickly and given last rites, and he was the last surviving founding father.
That's right.
And so just a great man in many ways. And so I chose him. And I think he's a guy who doesn't get his fair shake because there's not a monument to Madison in Washington, D.C.
I visited his homestead. I'm sure you have,
yes,
Virginia.
Sir.
Yeah, it was quite a thing to visit. My personal favorite president, George Washington, but my second would be John Adams. But maybe after reading your book, I might, maybe Madison will give John a run for his money.
Oh, he's a great guy. He really is in so many ways. He's such a champion of religious liberty, which to me is such an important thing. From the beginning, you know, that was his first sort of foray into politics, trying to establish religious liberty for Baptists in Virginia. He himself was not a Baptist, but his thing was if they can do it to Catholics and Baptists, they can do it to the rest of us. You know, and that was
because,
his first. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it was the Anglican Church was the state church of Virginia. Correct.
That's right.
And
that's right.
You needed a special permit to preach if you were from another denomination. And you were fined and even jailed.
That's exactly right. And not only that, but you had your, you know, if you had you had to pay what amounts to tithing to the Anglican Church.
That's
right. Because it was in their original constitution that the Anglican clergy would be supported by the people at large.
And that's interesting, too, because the notion of this separation of church and state, this First Amendment, it was never in the First Amendment because most of the original colonies, states, had state churches. Massachusetts, it was the Congregational Church, and we didn't need an ACLU to do away with that. It took maybe a full generation, but I think by the Madison was still alive when I think the last state church.
That's right.
The last state did away with the concept of state churches.
That's right. Yes, sir. And I mean, and today we look at that there are very few things, I think, maybe the Second Amendment, but the Second Amendment and the freedom of worship or freedom, you know, the right to free exercise of religion. Those are, I think, two of our liberties that are the most under attack. And I think those are the two that, boy, you know, the Second Amendment at the end of the day, even Madison said in Federalist 46, at the end of the day, the people are armed. And at the end of the day, no tyrant, no federal tyrant will be able to take their liberty because the people are armed.
Mm-hmm.
In Federalist 46, he says the last thing will be an armed populace, right, forming a militia. But we don't have a militia in any state, and slowly we're being disarmed. And with our right to, you know, free exercise of religion, where God is being marginalized more and more and more, and we're being forced to accept things that those who are Christians are repugnant and are, you know, a stench in the nostrils of the Almighty, and we're being forced to accept them as regular. Those two things, boy, you push God completely out and you leave us disarmed, and there's very little that we have to protect ourselves.
That's right. Well, we have just a few seconds left. Where can people find how to get a copy of this book and also read some of your incredible articles you've written over the years?
Yes, sir. For my articles, it's just thenewamerican.com, thenewamerican.com. And for the book, if you go right now before it's released, if you can get a little discount, and they'll send it out the next day. If you go to nccs.net, that's the National Center for Constitutional Studies.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, nccs.net. And it's right there on the front page on the left-hand side. It's the featured title. And if you click on through that, they have a way for you to order it at nccs.net.
That's where we get our constitutions, and we've been distributing them since Camp Constitution, since our inception in 08-09, we've distributed over 15,000, and we just distributed about 2,000 or 3,000 more just in the last month to some to the high school in New Hampshire, Manchester.
Yeah, well, Joe, I read about that.
Yeah, Joe, thank you so much for being a guest. I'd like to have you on again. And folks, thank you for listening, and until next week, may God bless you. You've been listening to Camp Constitution Radio on WBCQ The Planet.